Good morning. It's good to be back with all of you. As Beth shared, we had a wonderful vacation. You know it's a good vacation when you only use about an eighth of a tank of the rental car's gas. We just did not want to leave the beach. Other than the occasional jellyfish sting, we did pretty great. So it's interesting being a father, and I know many of you have been a father or a mother, now grandparents, maybe even great-grandparents. But you go through these stages in life, and you kind of forget about it until your kids start to go through those stages of life, and then your grandkids start to go through. But I was reminded yesterday, again, of the experience of walking through the lunchroom. Even for that very first time on the first day of school, Jeffrey went through that this year as a sixth grader. He went to the junior high for his first day, and there's that feeling of walking through and wondering, where am I going to sit for lunch? Which table will accept me? Who are my people this year? We watched a family movie off the Disney streaming app last night, and it was actually, it's an older movie, it's one from actually, Beth and I grew up with, but it's a modern retelling of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. And it went through that same thing as the kids are coming into high school for the first day. They're trying to figure out who their people are, who their peers are, where they'll be accepted. And I remember how important it was and how actually relieving it was when you figured out who your people were. Who are the group that was going to welcome you in? What was the group that was going to accept you and encourage you and be your people for the rest of that year and maybe many years further? Well, I don't keep track with everyone. There's still some friends that I have from those first days of a new school experience. In the same way for us as people of God, it's important for us to know who our people are. Who are God's people? It doesn't mean that as we provide fellowship with one another that we exclude the world, that we don't go out and make disciples or reach out to others. But again, it's important that we know who our people are. It was important to Jesus. It was so important to Jesus that he shared this section in the Sermon on the Mount. He's concluding the sermon. He's kind of winding it down. Next week, we'll go through the last passage as we talk about the wise and the foolish builder. But it was very important to Jesus to share some very strong words. Words that may not be welcome in every church today because they're words that feel a little bit divisive. They're words that draw a line in the sand. And I would say today, they're words that in the churches that need them the most, they're avoided. And in the churches that actually speak about this passage, preach about this passage, many of them might take it to extremes. So it's important for us as believers, it's important for us as the church to understand what it is to be part of God's family and how we know and how we recognize our people in the church and in the community. I've been to churches where you would get the idea that they thought heaven was going to be a very small and lonely place. It's not what Jesus is doing here. In fact, I went to a church with a friend. It was a small Baptist church, and I'm not knocking on Baptists. I have a lot of Baptist friends. I wouldn't even know that I would call this church Baptist, in all honesty. There was about 20 people there, and I introduced myself to the pastor. I was a ministry student at the time, excited about, you know, the Lord, ministry, and definitely pretty assured that I was going to heaven. But I went through and listened to what had to be best called ramblings, soapboxes, as we heard these messages that weren't very good, very political, very angry. But it was at the end of the sermon. Well, yeah, the second time at the end of the sermon that they began to pray and things got a little strange for me. Because I knew very clearly that I was the only new person there. No one else was visiting that Sunday. The preacher begins to say, "Lord, we know there's a sinner in our midst. Please bring him to salvation." And I was like, "Oh my, I think that's me." And I didn't know what to do, if I needed to drop to my knees, if I needed to tear my shirt, like what kind of a symbol could I give them that like I'm their people too? And again, it was a strange Sunday. So it's an October Sunday, a lot colder than it is today, a lot windier than it is today, and they were going to do a potluck outside. But as the sleet began to come, many decided they weren't going to be there. And I guess if I was in for a penny, I was in for a pound. And so I'm helping set up tables for the like 10 people that are left to come and eat the potluck meal together. And as I'm being pelted by the sleet, we pray for the meal. And the pastor says, "Lord, we see that the sinner is still with us." Again, I don't know what their vision of eternity looked like. Whether they thought there were going to be more than a few hundred people in heaven. Because if you heard them speak, you would think that heaven was a very, very small place. And it's passages like this that they had taken to extraordinary extremes that I believe they misunderstood that led them to that place. That if you are not just like us, the road is so narrow that only a few get through. But at the same time, I've been to very, very large churches, one that we joked about in Ohio. And these were great people. I'm not trying to make fun of them, but I would not want to teach children's ministry there. Because you walked in and they had soda fountains everywhere. So, you know, we often have coffee for church, but they had free Mountain Dew and Red Bull. And they had donuts and Snicker bars and just so much sugar. I can only imagine how much hair those children's workers lost as they tried to corral these kids. And they had thousands of people and they did lots of baptisms and there was a lot of good that happened there. But as you get into a church that big, God's message, Jesus' message here is still true. That we have to be aware that the road, that the path is narrow. And not everyone who travels that path with us. It's not that we're the judge, but we have to understand and be prepared that not everyone who travels the path will be children of God. We'll get into it, but Jesus talks about wolves in sheep's clothing. He talks about disciples who had cast out demons and prophesied, but they get to the throne in heaven and hear, "Away from me, I never knew you." We know that Jesus isn't a liar. So it's deeply important that we dig in and understand what he's talking about here. Because while maybe these words that he spoke more than 2,000 years ago to those gathered on the hillside, maybe they are a little divisive. Maybe they are a little hard to hear. And again, maybe many churches today either avoid it or take it to extremes. But I really believe as we dig into it, Jesus shows us some great tools that we can use to avoid being burnt by the hypocrisy that will come in any church. How many of you know someone who said, "Well, I used to go to church, but then this happened, and I'll never come back"? I think Jesus wanted us to be prepared for the fact that there will be people that will say and do hurtful things. There will be people who will act one way, but really be another. And that's part of us walking down that narrow road together. So Jesus points out to us who our people are and how we can know. And he does it through three comparisons. The first one I want to dig into today is looking at the wide and the narrow gate. Chapter 7, verse 13. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction. And many enter through it, but small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life, for only a few find it. It's important to begin with here that, especially in the NIV, which is what I read from, they have a problem with repetition. And so when the same word in Greek is repeated twice, they will often try and give it a little color and a little flair by changing it. But we're going to do ourselves a disservice if we try and compare the words small and narrow or the words wide and broad, because in our scripture, if we go back into the Greek, it's the same. He's talking about a narrow or small, same word, could be translated easily either way, road and gate. And he's talking about a broad or wide, same word, road and gate. And he's making this comparison. And he's saying that this gate and this road that leads to salvation, it's not real big. And it's not real big in that way that Jesus is really exclusionary, where he's trying to say, I don't want very many people there, because the scriptures make it very clear that God is not willing that any should perish. His desire is for everyone to come to salvation. But he also doesn't force himself upon us. And the reality is we will often find ourselves in the minority as we seek to be disciples of Jesus. So let's begin with the road. There are times in history that it feels like everybody's Christian. I remember there were times I grew up in a conservative area, and you know, if you asked everybody in the second grade what their faith was, almost everybody raised their hand and said, I'm a Christian. But then you got to high school, and that changed a lot. So our Arminian friends would say, well, they must have lost their salvation. The Calvinist friends would say they were never saved in the first place. But either way, we know that there are times that there will be those who identify walking down this road with us, that the road will feel crowded, but not everyone is truly living their faith. For me, it was hard to understand this the first time I participated in campus life in high school. And don't get me wrong, I think campus life can be a wonderful ministry. But the group of students that was my cohort was a rough one. Because the leaders in campus life, these Christian leaders, were also some of the meanest people I knew. And I had some nerdy friends, and these were the people that were probably the meanest to my friends. People I was trying to reach with the gospel. In fact, one of the stories, I was actually at a Pizza Hut, sitting down sharing a pizza with one of my good friends who wasn't a believer, and we're sharing, I'm sharing the reason for the hope that I have. I'm sharing my faith, and it's going quite well. And campus life gets out, about 100 students come in and invade the Pizza Hut. The captain of the basketball team, who happens to be one of the leaders, comes in, gives my friend kind of a noogie, doesn't even ask, grabs down, takes a piece of pizza off of the tray of pizza in front of us, proceeds to make a few jokes, and then walks off. My friend looks me in the eye and he said, if that's what being a Christian is, I want nothing to do with it. It's like, bummer. That evening was going so well till the rest of the Christians got there. Now again, if we fast forward a little bit, that guy who gave the noogie and stole the pizza, nothing to do with the faith today. In fact, I often heard some of the guys say, well, I go to campus life because that's where all the girls are. And they were going there, pretty girls, let's become a leader, date the pretty girls. So there's a lot of reasons that people will make decisions and identify as certain things. We see that in our culture today. It may not be as popular today to identify as a Christian. In fact, it's not very popular in many schools to identify as a Christian. But there are a lot of other identities floating around that have become very popular. That's why we see these statistical jumps. But throughout history, There may be points when the road feels crowded. We also see the harm of that, as so many identify as Christians, but don't really live like it. So don't be surprised. First of all, heaven will be a very diverse and beautiful and full place. So I don't want us to take this and go down the road that says, well, geez, not very many people get into heaven. Because eternity is a long time, and the past 2,000 years have been a long time. There's been a lot of time for even a narrow road to bring in many to salvation. So there will be so many people who don't look like us, sound like us, have cultures like us. It will be an amazing, diverse, rich, deep experience as we meet with the church when we cross into eternity. That being said, we can't expect that everyone in our culture will be walking down that narrow road with us. And we're not called to bring everyone along. We're called to grab one person at a time. That's what it means to make disciples. To grab our neighbor or our brother or our sister and say, I want to tell you about the hope that I have, and bring them down that road in a journey with us. If you can bring 12 people like Jesus did, fantastic, but I doubt you'll be able to bring 100. It's just not the way it tends to work. So don't be shocked when sometimes it feels like the rest of the world is going a different direction. When you flip on the news, and again, the news makes it sound so much worse. When you flip on the news and it feels like the whole world has gone to, I hate to be cliche, but hell in a handbasket. The second picture, and it's a beautiful one, is that of the gate. And I think we can continue the symbolism of the road into the gate, but the gate brings a little bit more. This idea that we have to unpack a little bit to get through the small and narrow gate. I don't know if you've ever been on the subway. I've got to take some mission trips with students to New York, and I got to do a lot with the subway there. That's kind of how you get around. But you go through some of those turnstiles and get in, and you can barely get in with anything. In fact, you know, there's not room for a backpack, hardly. Well, I think that's the picture that we see here. Jesus, in another story, tells us, he's talking to us, but he's also talking to, specifically, the rich young ruler. Many of you remember this from Sunday school or other sermons. The rich young ruler says, what do I need to do to enter heaven? And Jesus surprises him by telling him to give everything away that he has to the poor. And he leaves distraught and unhappy with the answer he received. And then Jesus turns to his disciples and he says something that I think we've all wrestled with. And I'm not trying to take away from if Jesus is saying something that is hyperbole, if he's trying to make a very strong point. But he says to the disciples, it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. And again, I don't know exactly what Jesus was doing here. He may have been trying to say something so absurd that shared that it was hard for a rich person to give up their riches and become a follower of Jesus. But there's another interpretation that I find fascinating. I think it fits with what we're talking about today. One of the gates in Jerusalem, it was the after-hours gate, was called the Eye of the Needle. And so at night, when everything was locked up so that you didn't have an invading army come through, they wouldn't open the big doors. If you've ever seen Wizard of Oz, you know they have the big door and then they have the little door the guy puts his head through at Emerald City. They would have a very small door, a lot like the one that you would get on to get on the subway, to get into the station. And there, you could get a camel through it, but it was hard. You had to unpack everything from the camel, all the saddle, and everything that was there to use to ride and drive the saddle, everything that it was carrying, and the camel had to get low. And I guess they can do this, but it was big enough pretty much for a man or a very contorted camel to get through. Because again, in the middle of the night, you didn't want an invading army making its way through your gate. You had to wake everybody up. You had to rally the troops if things got bad. So it was the night gate. The picture here is that this narrow gate, for us to get through it, there's a lot of baggage that we have to unpack. None of us have ever been to a funeral where the hearse was followed by a U-Haul truck. We don't get to take all this stuff with us. Jesus has shared this multiple places. Again, when we take this in the context of the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, it's this unpacking. So don't be surprised if the majority, if the crowd doesn't live for Jesus. They may not be our people. It doesn't mean they can't become it. One or two or three at a time. And it doesn't mean that God doesn't do amazing revivals. There have been points in history where we have seen the faith grow and spread in America, in Korea, in underground in China, in Africa. God's word can get out there and He can get a hold of people in a quick way. I don't want to limit God at all. But also, don't get too frustrated when it feels like following Jesus looks nothing like what the rest of the world is doing. Before World War I, there was actually this idea that started to really go through the seminaries and the Christian world. And it was this idea that maybe the millennial reign of Jesus that we talk about in Revelation, that we see in the end times, maybe Jesus doesn't return before that. Maybe we as the church do such a good job that we lead so many people to Jesus, that there's so much revival, that Jesus is like, man, they made heaven come true on earth. They brought and established the kingdom. It's time for me to come back. That became popular because there was revival that was happening before World War I. There was a lot of good things in Europe and in the United States. There was a lot of good happening. But then World War I happened. And we experienced trench warfare and mustard gas, and so many people lost their lives, and it was so brutal that the church was like, yeah, that was not a good idea. That wasn't ever going to happen. So don't get me wrong, we can see huge moves of God. But we can't get too discouraged when the road is narrow. And as we get to that gate, we've got to unpack it. It's not Jesus and. I tell people this all the time, and part of it's because I don't like network marketing very much, so I'm going to show my bias out there to everyone. But I've said you can't have your elevator pitch be Jesus and Amway, or Jesus and whatever the fancy tights are, or the new purses, or the essential oils, or whatever it is. We only get one elevator pitch. We've got to unpack everything else. And if we are God's people, what drives us is Jesus. So the narrow gate, the narrow road. The next thing Jesus shares with us that's so important is the warning against false prophets. In verse 15, "Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles?" Not all who claim to be Christian leaders are God's people. Some will use their influence and their position to enrich themselves and prey on the family of God. I think televangelism has done a good job of illuminating this in the eyes of the church. Anytime you have a pastor that comes on TV and said, "It's God's will for me to have a second Gulfstream jet." A second one? What about the first one? And I've personally experienced this through some of the churches I've been a part of. Some of you know that I actually was invited, when I worked at the country club, I was invited to a strip club by a former pastor I had at the end of a golf tournament when he was too drunk to even recognize me. It's a wolf in sheep's clothing. And I should have known sooner. There were so many red flags. If I had been better at inspecting the fruit, there was so much anger where there should have been love. There was so much revenge where there should have been peace and grace and mercy. There wasn't gentleness. There wasn't goodness. There certainly wasn't self-control. But Paul talks about this, the fruit of the Spirit. Against the fruit of the Spirit, there is no law, because if you are walking in the fruit of the Spirit, if that is what is outwardly coming out, it means the Spirit of God is in the driver's seat. Peace, I mean real peace, when everything is falling apart. That's supernatural. Love, real love, agape, unconditional love, even when the other person is hurtful or harmful, that's supernatural. Grace and forgiveness to those who have hurt us, that is supernatural. Like, we don't get to do that on our own. And here Jesus is saying that there are leaders out there. There are those who will say, I am great, and they will say the right things, and they will look the right way, and they will act the right way, at least most of the time. And it's hard because many of us, especially if you're in a larger church, you may not see your pastor at all outside of a half an hour message on Sunday morning. It's hard to see the day-to-day life of a spiritual leader. But Jesus says, we know that they are true, not wolves in sheep's clothing, but true believers, true people of God, if we judge the fruit that they bear. So this is important. Again, some of you may have been there. I don't know. I've heard some of your stories that you were away from church for a period of time because there was something that was said, there was something that was done, there was a leader who was inappropriate. We call it spiritual abuse. When you use your position of authority to harm someone else. And maybe it's just that they said some really horrible things to make themselves feel better and to make you feel small. But we know from the stories that are out there and the church too, kind of like the Me Too movement, that there have been so many pastors that have unfortunately used their position to abuse their parishioners, even sexually. They have grifted and stolen money from their churches. And as I serve on denominations, I've even in good denominations had to deal with, what do we do with a pastor that stole from the church? That used the church's coffers and the scholarship fund or whatever it was to line their own pockets. And it's easy to say, okay, well, I got burned by that leader. I'm never going to do it again. To become a little bit paranoid, a little bit conspiracy oriented, and to assume that now that's every pastor, that's every church, that's every leader. Jesus didn't want us to be shocked that these people would be out there. Because anywhere that there is influence, anywhere that there is wealth and power, and there are structures in place, there will be people who will try and take advantage of that. But Jesus gives us a very clear tool to help us overcome. And that is, he says, you will judge them by their fruit. And as we're congregationally governed in most churches here in America, excuse me, let me get a sip there. We need to be thinking about this when we have our board meetings. We need to be thinking about this when we have our congregational meetings. Are we structured in such a way that we know our pastor outside of a half an hour on Sunday morning, that we know our leadership team? Do we know what they're like when they go to the grocery store? Do we have any idea what they're like when they're at home with their kids? Do we have any idea what they're like when they're at a sporting event or a ball game or just walking in the park? What fruit do they show and do they share? It doesn't mean they're going to be perfect. But again, an apple tree doesn't grow thorns. And a thorn bush doesn't grow figs or grapes. We can hide who we are for a short time. But in the end, if we're paying attention, the truth comes out and the fruit is born. Are these leaders looking to enrich themselves? Are they looking to empower themselves? Or is their life about building God's kingdom? Because I'm sure you can do a lot to build God's kingdom for the price of a Gulfstream jet. And then finally, the true disciple. Verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, evildoers. One of the biggest kind of headache things I ever learned in the faith was the day I realized that the demons have faith too. So if you believe that all it takes to become a Christian is to believe that Jesus is who he said he was, don't the demons believe that Jesus is who he said he was? I mean, the demons never challenged Jesus' authority. They know because they were there. So the demons even have faith. And faith is important. I'm not saying that it's not. But Jesus says it right here. Says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only who? Only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. In other scriptures, Jesus says it like this. He says, if you love me, obey my commands. If you love me, obey my commands. And what I will say is, I believe that those who are children of God are those who love God. And if we love God, we will not be able to help but obey the commands. Does this mean that if you have a false thought, if you lie to your brother or sister, if you commit adultery, either physically or in your heart, by lusting after your neighbor's wife, that all of a sudden you are out, that you are ripped out of salvation? That's not what we're saying here. Not even close. The forgiveness of God is deep and it is rich. But again, if you're attracted like Simon the sorcerer, in the book of Acts, if you're attracted just to the power, to the influence, if you like the idea of being able to cast out demons or exert your influence, whether it's as a leader in the church or just over the spiritual realm, if you want to prophesy and you're all about having everyone hear you prophesy on the platform, but you don't obey God, your heart doesn't want to be in the scriptures, your heart doesn't want to be obedient, then I think there's a real concern there. And I'm not trying to be mean, and I'm not pointing any fingers, except for the ones back at myself. But if you love Jesus, you will obey His commands. And Jesus says clearly here that those who He will welcome into the kingdom are those not only who believe, but that belief becomes action, becomes obedience. We've all heard this. I mean, what does it mean to believe something? If I believe something is true, and I'm not a demon, and I'm not broken to the place where I can't even do anything to please God, then belief results itself in action. If I said to everyone that I don't believe that airplanes are safe, but I flew on them 3 or 4 times a year, I would be lying, right? Because why would I get on an airplane if I didn't believe it was safe? If I told you this chair was safe to sit in, and I sat there and snickered a little bit while you sat down at it and the thing collapsed, but I wouldn't sit in it, then I didn't really believe that the chair was safe. If we believe the truth of the gospel, then we will obey Jesus, that love will flow. If we really believe that Jesus has taken the punishment that we deserved, if we really believe the cross was our salvation, then we're going to want to respond in love. Remember Judas standing somewhere near Jesus as he's on the hillside sharing to the many, many in the crowd below. We know what happens to Judas. He betrays Jesus. Jesus understood this. And remember that in this large crowd of people, there will come a day, honestly, very soon, because we know that Jesus' ministry was only about 3.5 years from when it began at the wedding in Cana to when he was crucified. So wherever we are in that 3.5 years, there are so many that are cheering and believing and hearing the words of Jesus, but they may come with palm branches as he arrives in Jerusalem. But we know that so many of them will start yelling, "Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him!" days later. Jesus knows that of those in this crowd today listening to him, so many may be excited by what he has to say. They may be enthralled at his ability to teach. In fact, if you go and look at verse 28. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he taught as one who had authority and not their teachers of the law. They are amazed, they are excited, but yet almost all of them will yell, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" in front of Pontius Pilate. The true disciple is the one who obeys the will of the Father, is the one who obeys the commands of Jesus. And in no way does that mean that we earn our salvation. But obedience is the outward fruit of what God's doing on the inside. I love my charismatic brothers and sisters, and I had a lot of good experiences in the Pentecostal side of Christianity, but I had some hard ones too. And the most difficult thing for me to process, for me to reconcile, was there was this great and wonderful idea of being chosen by God. You would talk to a minister in a charismatic church, and they were so excited that God had chosen them, and that was fantastic. But they didn't always feel the need to follow that up with obedience. And God chooses us. He's chosen each of us that have responded. None of us are unique in that. God is not willing that any should perish. And I'm so glad that so many of us have responded to that grace. But it's not just about saying, "Look at me, I've been chosen by God." It's about responding and beginning to bear that wonderful fruit of obedience. "God, I trust you. And now, even when I don't understand it, I'm going to do what you say. I'm going to live like you've called me to live. I'm going to give sacrificially. I'm going to carry my cross and follow you." Because remember the words of Jesus, "If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. No servant is greater than his master." So in the same way that Jesus was treated, we should expect no different. That's why the road may feel narrow sometimes. And it may not feel very crowded. But if we love Him, we will obey His commands. We will pick up our cross, even when it's painful. And we will follow Him because the rewards begin now in practicing the presence of God. Getting to experience the eternal Creator of the universe here and now, all the way into eternity. Worship team, would you come forward?